You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Among the more outspoken critics of American foreign policy vis-a-vis Iraq is Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General under President Lyndon Johnson. Since the 1991 Gulf War, Clark and his organization, the International Action Center, have delivered several shipments of food and medicine to the people of Iraq in violation of U.S.-led economic sanctions on that country. Ramsey Clark is also the founding chairman of the activist group International Answer, or Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, which has organized dozens of anti-war rallies and teach-ins in New York, Washington, and across the country, including some of the largest anti-war protests since the Vietnam War. He spoke and responded to questions from the audience yesterday at the National Press Club here in the nation's capital.
I want to thank the National Press Club for giving me this opportunity to discuss with you the enormously important question of U.S. militarism and its threat to the destiny of humanity. We see the military glorified in the media, particularly in the entertainment segments of the media. I've thought since my years in the Department of Justice that we've seen violence itself glorified, the power of violence, glorified in our culture, and I don't recommend it. Might does not make right. If the idea that the U.S. militarism is a threat to the destiny of humanity, I'll confess to having borrowed the phrase from the Pope, who in March of this year characterized the conflict between Iraq and the United States as a threat to the destiny of humanity. And I think he's right. This country of ours has committed the most serious act of aggression in its history. It is engaged in a war of aggression without a declaration of the Congress, as the Constitution recommends, without approval of the Security Council of the United Nations, but more significantly, in clear violation of the most important provisions of international law, which seek to end the scourge of war. As a young Marine, I sat briefly on two occasions in the Nuremberg hearings. And we really need to refer back to the constitution of the Nuremberg Tribunal, because there we'll find that the first crime to be prosecuted, the most important crime to prevent, was set forth in Section 6A, described generally as crimes against peace. And the first crime against peace is a war of aggression. And a war of aggression is an attack on another country that presents no threat of imminent danger to you. And I don't believe any objective person on evidence available could believe that Iraq was an imminent threat, danger to the United States. We killed about 150,000 people in Iraq with our 42-day assault, 88,500 tons of bombs, 110,000 aerial sorties in 1991. We claimed to destroy 80% of their armor, their tanks, their artillery, their personnel carriers. They've had no means for replenishing those. We destroyed many of their young men through the Security Council, but at our insistence, we imposed sanctions that are genocidal, that caused the deaths, according to every UN agency that deals with children, with health, with food, or with human rights, 1.5 million deaths for lack of nutrition, for lack of medicine. And the majority of that 1.5 million deaths were children under the age of 5. The next largest category are the elderly, people most vulnerable to sickness and to the effects of poor health care and bad water and disease, malnutrition. This time we attacked with all of our technology and power. We can destroy any country on earth without ever setting foot on it. Our military budget, each of these last 12 years, has exceeded the gross domestic product of Iraq by 20-fold. We spend 20 times more on arms annually than Iraq has for all the needs of all of its people and all the excesses of some of them. All of its oil that was sold in the years after 1996 when oil was sold, 20 times. We attacked a country that was defenseless, was known to be defenseless before we attacked. We sent missiles that they never saw until they hit. How many times have you seen concern about how many Iraqis were killed? Just as how many times you read in the press about whether crimes were committed in the attack on Iraq? We see daily in the media, particularly recently, claims that people are digging up body bags of relatives they're looking for from the past. Why wouldn't people be looking for the bodies of those who were killed this time? Iraq lost about 200,000 people in the Iran-Iraq war. Who's going to tell us who are in these body bags? Two or three of the graves have already been identified as graves where bodies were hurriedly buried during the Iran-Iraq war between 1980 and 1988. It's a propaganda effort to further demonize the people, to poison the well, to somehow or other justify the right of the United States to reach halfway around the world and destroy the country. I spent a lot of time in Iraq between 1989 and 2003. I've been there this year, too. It's true I've met Saddam Hussein three or four times. We spent at most 2.5 hours together at any given time, and I'm not sure he would remember my name if he's still around. I spent plenty of time with the people, plenty of time seeing what their condition was, and plenty of time trying to figure out how many people were dying from sanctions in the hospitals and in the countryside. And my estimate of the numbers killed in this most recent engagement is at least 30,000. Of the 30,000, at least 5,000 are civilian. I mean, frequent press reports have referred to 2,500 dying in Baghdad alone, civilians. But I think 5,000 is quite low. 25,000 military is quite conservative, too. The United States claims to have destroyed 70% of the Republican Guard, which had 80,000 men, according to our figures. That's 56,000 alone. Of course, I don't believe the 70%. But suppose it were 20%. 80,000 weren't 20% of the entire regular military in service at the beginning of the war without reserves. What was all that shock and awe? Was it just fireworks like the 4th of July, or was it killing people? The heavy bombardments. And how did we let them get away with a phrase like shock and awe? Tell me the difference psychologically between what is intended by shock and awe and 9/11. It's sudden, devastating violence against a defenseless people by surprise, seeking awe that will make them tremble and surrender. Do we really believe in a phrase like that? Do we really want people to submit from shock and awe? I can't believe that those who wrote the Constitution wouldn't be nauseated by the suggestion that we would have been reduced to such a miserable expression that would be accepted by the people of the United States as a means of having our way. The media needs to find out how many Iraqis die. Don't they matter? Are their lives worth less than ours? And we've flawed our weaponry as if legality made no difference. How is it that we're again finding cluster bombs in the cities? Cluster bombs shouldn't be used anyplace. They're fragmentation bombs that can slice anything to ribbons over field of 5 or 6 football fields. And here they are in cities. 10% don't explode because there are hundreds or thousands in a mother load. And children pick them up and set them off by playing with them and are killed. And we've seen many instances of that already since the end of this conflict. Depleted uranium. Enormous protest against depleted uranium, which the United States didn't announce it was using, was only discovered in 91. and finally has admitted it used about 350 tons of depleted uranium. And the effects on children, particularly in the southern part of the country, fetuses with cancer, thousands of children born deformed with tumors and cancers, whole fields of medicine in the southern Iraq devoted, and elsewhere in the country too, to what you do about the effects of depleted uranium. And now the Guardian from England, but I haven't seen it in the papers here, has told us that at least 1,000 and perhaps 2,000 tons of depleted uranium were used this time. For what purpose, for God's sake, you know? How do you get rid of this stuff? Its half-life is more than 1 billion years. That's quite a while. We're still using daisy cutters. They just crush people. Huge explosive forces that are weapons of mass destruction. We harbor the vast majority of all the weapons of mass destruction, particularly the most destructive, and we have beyond the capacity of any other country the ability to deliver them wherever we want to, any time we want to, all over the place at a given time. And yet we demand absolute obedience to our authority. Do this within 2 days, do this within a week. When we see the nature of the occupation, when we see the chaos in which the people are living, when we realize, in spite of the fact that the government of the United States was implored to see that there were emergency medical supplies spread throughout Iraq before any attack, because there are a lot of us that saw, for instance, as I saw, an 11-year-old girl have her left leg sawed off very near the hip while four men held her down. And again, there was no anesthesia, even though long letters characterizing what would be needed. And even now, they haven't gotten emergency medical supplies in. We claim we wouldn't hit the water and we wouldn't hit the electricity, but there's no water and there's no electricity. And they're reporting outbreaks awfully early in the year in Basra, of cholera, of typhoid in a number of cities. And the people have no means of finding medical services. And this is what's happened from our assault on the people there. Culture wasn't spared. Mesopotamia is an ancient place. We've heard a lot about the looting of the National Museum, which was an incredible repository of the histories of many civilizations going back over a period of more than 5,000 years. Let's all hope and pray that most of those were put away someplace where they're safe and weren't actually looted. But we know that the National Library and its archives were burned to the ground. Burned to the ground. And we know that the very major Quranic library in the Ministry of Culture was burned to the ground. And all over the country, many sites were destroyed. The numbers of crimes that we have committed beyond the worst crime of all, the war of aggression, are too lengthy to count, but they include an absolute disregard for all the international law that sought to protect the right of prisoners. You remember in the good old days when it was name, rank, and serial number? World War I and World War II? And now we see people carried out in Guantanamo. They're on stretchers, comatose. And we see them staggering out, barely able to walk. We don't know their names, and their mothers don't know where they are. And they're held indefinitely, and we claim the power to hold them. We're doing the same in Iraq. No one knows where Tariq Aziz is. He has many friends in the diplomatic world all over the world. And here, because we have the power and we say that might makes right, we'll do what we want. Even the president goes to the length of calling him a liar. He lied before, he lies now. But you can't hear from him. You don't know where he is. You don't know his condition. You know his sister said he had 2 heart attacks. Between the time of the beginning of the bombing and the time that he turned himself in. Have we lost all respect for any principle, for any rule of law? It's time that we recognize that the Constitution of the United States, at length, and more than with any other single issue it addressed, dealt with the problem of the imperial presidency, the possibility of that, or crimes by officers of the United States. They dealt with it at length because they were concerned about it. The Articles of Confederation hadn't worked. There was no executive. The government was dysfunctional. They didn't like the idea of a king. It had some problems with George III. And in fact, if you want to look at it, the Declaration of Independence is basically a bill of impeachment by the United States against George III. That's all it is. That's what it says. And so they tried to provide the means by which we, the people, could protect ourselves from an imperial presidency. And there are six separate provisions in the Constitution for impeachment. The key and first one says that the president, the vice president, and other officers of the United States shall be removed from office upon impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. It says shall. And for people who believe in the law, could it be less? Do we really think the rest of the world believes that our assault on Iraq complied with international law? Then where are the scholars that say so? Because they don't say so. Doesn't matter whether you go to Cambridge or Yale or Ohio State or Princeton or UC Santa Barbara. They all say the same thing. It's the first crime against peace, because it is the first crime against peace. And here we're doing it, and not only doing it, we're threatening others right now. I wasn't born to be threatened. I would stand with Thoreau on that. I might have been willing to do something until I was threatened, and then by golly, I will be stubborn. I won't do it. Because if you tolerate that sort of thing, you lose your self-respect and you lose your freedom. And yet here we are almost daily threatening Syria, demanding this, that, and the other. Threatening Iran, demanding this, that, and the other. Threatening North Korea. Coming back to all the usual suspects, Cuba. Now we're going to make a case on Cuba, how to win friends and influence people. It's imperative that we face our duty to process impeachment. We put up a website, well, it was before March the 19th, and we've now had something close to 200,000 sign on voting to impeach. It's www.votetoimpeach.org. In addition, we've had paper ballots out, and we're still in the process of counting them. And the two together total more than 250,000, a quarter of a million. Do we stop because it seems the war is over? Absolutely not. Do you stop after the crime? It's too bad you couldn't prevent it, but you couldn't prevent it. You failed to prevent it. But if you don't do something now, how are you going to prevent it next time? Impossible. How many months was the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton on the front pages of the papers of the United States, you know, and still talked about constantly? And you're going to compare that with seeing more than 100,000 heavily armed men who are invincible, not because they're physically stronger or morally stronger necessarily, but because they've got the technology, that's all. They can wipe you out. Richard Nixon was removed from office, forced to resign because of the threat of conviction after impeachment. And historians concede that now. He was good at head counts. And when he saw that he was losing Republicans in the Senate, he knew he better get out of there. And he did. And here we have this incredible use of violence that threatens the future of the United Nations, that violates the Charter of the United Nations, that threatens a continuum. It's created chaos beyond Iraq. I mean, we see what's happening with the Shiite Muslims there, and we see what's happening with the Kurdish people there, and we see the possibility of unity there diminishing every day, and we see the condition of the people, the poorest it has been at any given time in modern history in Iraq. And we see our angry fist shaking in the face of other people that we used to proclaim have sovereign rights and individual freedom, and we don't act. I urge everyone who cares about the integrity of our Constitution to take back the Constitution by insisting that the House of Representatives, which has the sole power of impeachment, process impeachment proceedings now against President Bush and the major people who participated in launching this war of aggression. Let me end with this. Somehow or other, we've tried to tell ourselves that the old rules don't matter anymore, that it's too dangerous now. But we say that in every time a problem comes up, don't we? Let's hearken back to Abraham Lincoln at a time that was considerably more dangerous than anything that we face. The greatest danger that we face is ourselves and our own militarism. In 1860, at what was then called the Cooper Institute in New York, Abraham Lincoln ended an address that he said, together with photos of Matthew Brady, elected him president, with this phrase: "Let us have faith that right makes might. And in that faith, let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it."
First question. We have a lot of questions to get in. How realistic is it to expect that the U.S. Congress would impeach President Bush, given the fact that they are the same Congress that granted the authority to invade?
Well, I think that last part of the question is debatable. I'm not sure that people voting back in the fall could foresee what would happen, and there was certainly the anticipation that he'd go back to the United Nations. But there's also the Constitution, and the Constitution doesn't say they can give him the authority to invade except by a declaration of war. But that aside, the realistic part is the Congress will do what the people of the United States demand that it do. If they show no interest now, it's because the media has shown no interest, the people are uninformed, and they're unaware of the dimension of what's happened and what it portends for the future. But I'll tell you that I believe that there are millions and millions of Americans who would insist that their member of the House of Representatives vote to impeach. We're not convicting yet. You haven't impeached yet. If they only had access to adequate information and understood where we are. But the Congress is not going to act until the people do. And unfortunately, our plutocracy doesn't give them a lot of contact with their constituents.
What are the prospects of uniting the various anti-war elements into a coalition that would vote Bush out of the White House in 2004? And what do you think of the fact that many of the Democratic presidential candidates actually supported this war?
You know, we have such a vast, I don't like the phrase, but military-industrial complex. There's not a congressional district in the country. It doesn't have a major military contractor or a major military base within that congressional district, 435 of them in the United States. And you see the best peace members of the House saying, "But not the ones in my district," because the tentacles of the complex have tied them down. But also the whole thrust of the country, of corporate power and globalization ambitions and the idea of New World Order. It's the opposite of what we started out to be. We came here so we could live as we chose, so we could pray as our fathers taught us to pray, so we could live a life of happiness and fulfillment. And now we're trying to reach out to dominate the whole world and to do it through militarism. The power is in the people, and the Congress will gladly respond when it feels the people awakening and hears their demand.
If so many people want to impeach President Bush, though, why is his popularity so high in the polls, and why did they give Bush and the Republicans control of both of the houses of Congress last fall?
You ask questions as if politics were a rational matter. It's always amazing. President Bush is the hottest thing since Sylvester Stallone right now, you know. I mean, you can't get better than Rambo until he did. And glory's in it. I mean, you can almost feel his passion for militarism because he believes that he's right. His might can make that right the way he wants the world to be. But I think that the popularity is paper thin. I think popularity in political life in the United States is nearly always paper thin. I don't mean to analogize 92 with 02 or 93 with 03, but President Bush's popularity reached an all-time high in the polls during our history of using polls, which I don't particularly believe in the spring of 1991. And he lost the presidency to governor from a very small state that few people had heard of less than 2 years later. And that's how quick it can turn around. Unfortunately, if the economy is good, you can get away with any sin you want to, apparently, in the White House. But that's not the way it ought to be. If we're going to live a life of principle, we have to face the acts of our government because we are responsible for what it does.
Do you think it makes a difference in this post-war analysis whether weapons of mass destruction are found in Iraq, and do you think they will be?
Well, in law, it never made a difference. If the mere possession of weapons of mass destruction justified a military attack, there are at least 35 countries that could be attacked right now. Because at least 35 countries, by all people who study these things, have weapons of mass destruction. I'm not talking about only nuclear. Most of these things remain somewhat of a mystery, but when you take biological and chemical, and we've said for years that these are the weapons of mass destruction for the poor countries. They can't afford the cost of high-priced technology of mass destruction. So obviously the mere presence of a weapon of mass destruction, any more than the mere presence of a gun in a person's hand in the United States, doesn't justify killing the person. It can't. The only thing that can justify it is an imminent threat to life. In international affairs, the life of your country, or serious injury to it. And in domestic affairs, the life of a police officer or somebody else threatened by someone. And it has to be an immediate threat, otherwise you just start popping people. We ought to remember that the president has authorized assassination. Is that what we want the country and our government, the people of the United States, to stand for, assassination? But he began the assault on Iraq with an attempt to assassinate, and he ended it with an attempt to assassinate. He said in his State of the Union message, one of the most amazing things I've ever heard a president say in public, "We've captured about 3,000 members of Al-Qaeda and other terrorists, and many others have met a different fate." Let me put it this way. They won't be around to bother us anymore. That means we eliminate them. Summary execution. A criminal act, it is murder. You don't kill people without a court order and without a trial.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Brian Becker and Askia Mohammed for assistance with that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their websites at PacificaArchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.